Hello and welcome to the Writer's Block. Yes, people, it's the Writer's Block. It's a Sunday. It's 10 p.m. here over in lovely Skopje, Macedonia. The weather has been absolutely miserable for the past couple of days, and this is why I'm so chipper. I'm like the opposite of the weather. The better is, the worse I feel. But today, we're going to have such a ball of a time. Tonight with me, I have Mr. Jim Goad returning due to popular and editorial demand. Jim, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing fantastic. It's getting cold here in Georgia, believe it or not. I want to punch anybody who tells me like it gets cold down south. Yeah, we're in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. It gets cold. Like freezing this morning. I hate it. And are you frozen? Oh, it looks like when I said freezing, like I cast a spell on you and you froze. Wow.
It's one of those serendipities, I guess. And I am personally fascinated by the effects of high elevation on climate. I could probably do a 6-hour show on that, just the effects of mountains and how they stop the flow of weather, the flow of moisture, the flow of cold, the flow of heat. Just terrain is a major factor in weather, and wherever you are in the world, even if it is scorching hot, there are regions of that place which can be freezing cold, as I learned to my detriment when trying to climb Mount Etna in Sicily in the middle of summer. It's cold up there near the peak, and I just couldn't continue. But it is what it is. The weather's getting colder. We're finally seeing November's true face showing itself. And, of course, while everyone else of the Countercurrents crew is over hobnobbing, bebopping, and skedaddling over at American Renaissance, Mr. Goad and I are holding the fort, and we will be taking care of your entertainment for tonight. We will be discussing J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy. I guess he's a senator now. We have to take him seriously or something. So
I'm not sure if I know of any senators that I take seriously, but sure. I'm kind of amazed like Trump supported him in the end, right? Because when I wrote a negative review of Hillbilly Elegy about 4 years ago, and he had nothing good to say about Trump and lots of good things to say about Obama. He talked about homophobia, racism, sexism, as if they actually existed. I don't know. And he just has that beaver face. He's untrustworthy. His face is too, it's like a pumpkin. So I don't know what's to like about him. But I guess it's one Republican vote as if that's going to change what exactly. I'd really like to know. I'm really starting to suspect that everyone's just been sucked into this endless stag beetle clash, and to distract them from the fact everything's falling apart. I'm not sure what one senator is going to be able to do.
Indeed, it's a very important question we have to pose ourselves. We have already been suckered several times into believing that this or that politician is the second coming of, well, choose your favorite reactionary figure from the past. But we'll see. We'll see where we're going to give Mr. J.D. Vance a chance. Okay, that's
give Vance a chance. Okay.
Yeah, give Vance a chance.
Who did he went against? Tim Ryan.
It's the low energy slogan for the demoralized white nationalists.
Give Vance a chance. Yeah. He was Tim Ryan, that blockhead that he went against, right? In Ohio. That's a state that got pretty much benighted by deindustrialization and offshoring and immigration. That's the Rust Belt. That's what gave Trump the first 2016 election. Not even going to get into which one was stolen, whether it was stolen, but the night he was declared the winner of the 2020 election, before I went to sleep, I wrote an article for Countercurrent saying, you know, a Trump victory, don't blame white males, because according to exit polls, if you can trust them, a lower quotient voted for him than in 2016. And higher quotients of, I think, just about everybody else voted for him in 2020. If you can trust the exit polls, maybe they're rigged too. I think we're getting into this terror dome where no one believes anything and everyone feels constantly gaslit. I mean, you have to question. And I think that's pretty deliberate. They're probably inducing this mass psychosis.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically the elites are in a position where nobody in their right mind trusts what they're saying. So what they're trying to do now is they know they can never regain the trust of the population. What they can do is disrupt belief in the possibility of truth and then rule as the most cohesive group in a situation where everyone is so confused and confounded and can never really trust anybody because the very notion of trust and truth have been undermined, right? It's we have actually seen this before. This is the norm of Russian propaganda post-fall of the Soviet Union. They're no longer trying to convince you of anything in particular. They're trying to get you to doubt truth itself, the possibility of truth, or at the very least, sincerity.
I've said it many times. You ever see that Theodore Dalrymple quote about communist propaganda? He worked in the prison system in England. He was a psychiatrist. And he said, in my experience, communist propaganda, it's not to inform or to educate. It's to demoralize and humiliate. And once you get people like assenting to obvious lies, you've broken them and you don't really have to do anything else. And that's, I mean, they're coming at us with so many obvious lies. The tranny thing and, you know, the emperor's new body. Oh, yeah, that woman looks great. And, you know, you're doing it, or the people who do that sort of thing do it to save their job, but they also know they've been broken. Yep. Something feral elite. Has been ripped out of them.
Elite are those who refuse to lie. And for the time being, we're going to have to be voices in the wilderness, but our time will come. Surely, surely, all hope has not been beaten out of us. And, well, speaking of hope, I know it's horrible for fundraising morale, but I have to tell the truth. But we do have, if you are indeed interested in helping out this project, Countercurrents as a general organization, my own work, Jim's work, the writer's block, there are several ways to do it, and we're going to get into them. We have some crass financial concerns to get into. And below our portraits, you can see ticking away the Entropy stream, donation link, and the Cash App donation link. Now, over on Entropy, you can send us your donation and attach a comment or a question. Oh, and I just remembered I forgot to open the Entropy account. So
bring the questions on, absolutely.
Yeah. You can ask us questions. We're going to answer them to the best of our ability. You can also send us your comments, maybe, you know, comments about my goatee. You may have noticed I have grown a goatee because I am now officially an asshole. And this is the official...
this is how it's manifesting. Okay.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, you're not allowed to be an asshole unless you have a goatee, and you're not allowed to grow a goatee unless you're a bona fide asshole, which is why it's coming in so nicely. So, you know, you want to call me an asshole. That's fine. Just please refrain from insulting the guests. That is not that.
If I can leapfrog off of that, I noticed a while ago, this was like pivotal to me. It was maybe 10 years ago. It was after Vice started going woke and like sold out to the billionaires. They started, anyone who had unacceptable opinions, they referred to as an asshole. Which, you know, being from my generation, which you always like to bring the generations up, an asshole back then was someone who eats your French fries when you go to the bathroom, or, you know, steals your woman or does something rude. It was never contingent on what they believed. That to me is a dangerous development, that someone is a bad person because they think differently. It wasn't always that. I mean, I guess if you were openly pro pedophilia, I guess people could make a case that you were an asshole. But for the most part, behavior and beliefs were two completely different things. Now they're indistinguishable.
Right. It used to be, well, you know, even if you have the, even if you are, for example, pro-pedophilia, that doesn't mean you have to be rude at the lady in the checkout aisle. So I'm not sure that would be a case for assholism. A pedophile, yes, and this person should be hanged, but he's not an asshole. Let's not be unfair. And of course, we have to be fair to people. We have to be fair-minded. If you want
many,
to donate,
many empires were lost in the interest of fairness. That's something, what was it? The Lucifer Principle, the book. He said, and this always stuck with me too, that empires usually fall after they start making concessions, not at the height of their despotism, but when they start making concessions, because animals smell that as weakness, and that's when they're overthrown. Like in the US, the riots of the 60s were after, and I think Steve Saylor was the first one I saw to point this out. After the Civil Rights Act, after the Voting Act, you know, after the Immigration Act, then it's like, all right, let's see how far we can. Let's see how far we can. It's like a woman. They're like, the blacks were shit testing us back in the 60s. Well, all right, they're starting to get weak. Let's just see how weak they are.
Turns out we're pretty well. American whites are pretty weak. Not that us over here in Europe are any tough guys or macho men. No, we're getting trampled underfoot by all sorts of...
I have a friend who's sending me pictures of the metro in Paris, and it looks like the you know, the MARTA in Atlanta. That's Metro Atlanta Rapid Transit Authority, or Moving Africans Rapidly Through Atlanta. There was only no white people on it. It was Asians and blacks in Paris.
Believe it or not, about the only time in my life where I have been attacked by a mugger, not successfully mugged, but attacked by a mugger, was in Paris on the metro, on the line between La Défense and somewhere near the Louvre, I forget. It was, and of course, the perpetrator was black. I mean, every single time, what can I say? Who else would have done it? And that's about the only time I've been attacked by another man with who had the intention of stealing my money, right? A mugging. I've been attacked other times for other reasons, right? Most of them relating to honor, to competition over women, fender benders. But this was the only time I had been the victim of an attempted mugging, and it was a black man, and it was on the Paris metro. It was, I think, more than 10 years ago now.
As luck would have it, this would have been in the late 70s. I was in Center City, Philadelphia, and a black dude stuck a snub-nosed revolver in my stomach, and I gave him all seven of my dollars and walked the 8 miles home. And I remember walking through West Philly, "Hey, white boy," like being screamed at for being a white boy. But that's what happens when you're walking around Center City, Philly, like some black guy's going to steal your money, apparently. That was the only time I've been robbed at gunpoint.
Well, I'm sure it was a hard-earned lesson. Speaking of robbery at gunpoint, we are running a fundraiser here. So all of the donation links, I already mentioned Entropy. Now, we also have Cash App. Now, Cash App, you cannot ask questions. You cannot attach comments to the Cash App donation. But, however, they take a lesser percentage of the donation than Entropy. So if you just want to give something to us out of the goodness of your heart, Cash App is the way to go. And aside from that, we have MoonPay. What happens with MoonPay is you take your credit card and you transform your fiat currency into cryptocurrency, and it ends up in the countercurrents, crypto wallets, and that's how we fund this operation, among other things. And, of course, then there's the options of where we are streaming, Odyssey and DLive. We are accepting lemons on DLive. We are accepting diamonds and ice creams and ninja guineas and ninjets and all of those delightful things. So you can donate there. And on two donations of a diamond and higher, that's 100 lemons, you can also attach questions and comments. So those are greatly appreciated. And we are also taking donations over on Odyssey. Now, you can send us a cash donation over on Odyssey. What you do is you type out your comment in the comment box, and then the dollar sign comes online, and you press that to give us a donation, a cash donation over on Odyssey. And you can also donate to us on Odyssey with their very own cryptocurrency, the Library Coin, which I'm not sure how much it is in dollars, but they are used to upload videos over on Odyssey. So we need them to keep to put these replays up on Odyssey for your viewing pleasure, insofar as you want them. I mean, the replays are always up on the Countercurrents website, but some people like them up on Odyssey for whatever reason. So it always helps, even if all you have are library coins, your donations are greatly appreciated. Now, those are all the direct ways in which you can donate, and again, we appreciate that. There's also an indirect way. And that is to purchase the fine products of our sponsors, Alaska Chaga.
Loves me some Alaska Chaga.
Oh, are you having Chaga too, Jim?
Yeah, I'll never tell. You know, of course, it's great. I'm getting high off of it right now. Actually.
Exactly. What a buzz. It's a magical mushroom.
Just this overwhelming sense of well-being. Permeating my pores. It's fantastic. Buy it. Donate as much as you can.
Yeah, give us all your money.
Give us all your money.
How do you say give us all your money in French? I forget. I mean,
donnez-moi tout le. I'm not sure how you say money. Yeah.
Dame los dineros. Okay, that's a different.
Dineros. Yeah, that's we're crossing over. Yeah, in 3 years. That's all I got out of 3 years of French in high school.
I don't know. I was in Paris for 5 days, got mugged on one of those days. So, One of those days, one of those things, I guess.
One of these things where it's, I'm sorry, it's tempting to one up you, but my brother got murdered in Paris.
Yeah.
I mean, checkmate. I bit my lip and then I came out with it, but yeah, nasty place. And, I think that'll be the center of, like, if Europe really starts falling apart, Paris is going to be one of the first to, like, completely burn to the ground.
Well, you know what they say, the bigger they are, the higher they fall, because you go to Paris and you realize underneath all of the junk and the blacks and the Arabs and everyone, and even the fucking French, and they tend to be very rude to outsiders who are not non-white, because to me, they were very rude. The native Parisians.
Okay.
The white Parisians. They were very rude, and it was very an unpleasant experience to be so ostracized while there are literal racial aliens running around the streets, robbing and rioting and burning things.
Well,
you know what? At least I came to your country to spend money and to marvel at its architecture and art. The least you can do is be a little polite to me. You know, yeah, I came as a tourist, and yeah, we're obnoxious, but I'm not robbing you, and I'm not setting your cars on fire. Can you at least not yell at me in the street?
Sure, they were a little less poncy back in the time of Charles Martel or Napoleon, but they've been the doormat of Europe for a while now. I mean, how long did it take Hitler to get to Paris? Like 2.5 hours? Like they just rolled over.
Which is why I say, you know, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. But underneath all of that, Paris is a magnificent and magical place. You understand that this place was probably at one point the greatest city in the world.
Just I'll tell you, I was spoiled, like, because I came from Venice. And Paris looked like Cleveland in comparison.
Oh, my God.
And after a couple of days in Rome, like, Paris really looked like a dirty. It was not nearly as mind-blowing. And being from Philadelphia, they sent all the bad Italians over to Philadelphia because I was just in awe. I was walking around, like tiptoeing around Italy because I didn't want to break anything. Everything was so perfect. Paris, yeah, it was underwhelming, as was London. Favorite cities, I think I liked Amsterdam a lot, Berlin and Italy and Stockholm, but Oslo was nice, but Paris wasn't very high up there. I've only been in Europe once, and it was for like 6 weeks back in 1985.
Well, you should come and visit whenever you can. But
I'm not sure I can, passport-wise and everything. They wouldn't let me into Australia last time, back in 2007.
That's unfortunate. I don't know.
Well, it's ironic, too. It's a colony of like ex-convicts. And the descendants of convicts.
As people have pointed out, more Australians are descended from prison guards than convicts. And it shows up in the mentality, which is, it's a shame. I mean, it's a wonderful place I hear, and I would hope to visit it sometime. But due to our activism here, I don't think I'd be given a visa.
I got there once, and I was very impressed. And also, you want race realists? I've never met any like the Australians. It's like I imagine being in Alabama in the 1930s. I remember going over this guy. He was a zine. He published some horror zine, and I had dinner with his family, and I was asking him about Aboriginal art. And the mother's just like, it's just dots. It's nothing but a bunch of dots. Even more ominously, though, he's driving me around downtown Melbourne, which was unexpectedly huge. It's like the size of Chicago. And he said, well, here's the thing. We're a nation of about 20 million people. Directly north of us is a nation of 1.5 billion people. And Australia, as we know it, is not going to last. First 24 hours I got there, I was bombarded with the word multiculturalism more than I'd ever seen it. I think I saw one black person in Melbourne like in a week there. They talk, it's always the places that aren't multi, and maybe that's part of the plan. Like if it's sufficiently multicultural, they don't have to push it anymore. But it's always the places like Minneapolis. I think Minneapolis has achieved quantum multiculturalism. But yeah, Portland. Mass. Portland used to be like this idyllic town when I moved there in the early 90s. But everyone knows what Portland's just an open air drug market. And, you know, people are doing crocodile and everything in the streets. Every drug is legal. Like you can have like under a certain amount of heroin, anything in Portland now. It's crazy. And they have, I talked to a friend. This is a messed up story. I'll try to get through this quickly. His wife left him, became a street junkie in Portland, and had a baby with another street junkie. And they abandoned the baby. He had no blood connection to it at all. But under Oregon law right now, he has to pay for the like $1 million of health care that this malformed baby in an oxygen tent. Why aren't they legally liable? Well, if you're an addict in Oregon, you're either actively doing the drug, at which point you're an addict. And if you did it 10 minutes ago, you're in recovery. You're a victim in either case. So they are legally not liable for that kid. It's crazy what happened there. Portland is just, it's a petri dish of the future. It's unsettling.
So your new American dream is develop a drinking problem, move to Portland.
When you're a
not
child.
Like, in that order.
Yeah. Deep Ray Milland Lost Weekend level alcoholism, like before puberty, I think is the only way to maintain sanity at this point.
Indeed. We have been getting donations and questions. Jim is a popular guest, as always. We have $10 from Gadius Maximus, and he asks, Jim, what's with the boxes?
The boxers?
There are boxes behind you, Jim.
Boxes. Those are actually, those are stacks of, well, I guess it's time to shill here. Answer Me has been printed. Those specific boxes are the extras that you get. This is a hoax zine that we did pretending that we were interracial lesbians who hated us. And we sent it out to everyone who'd criticized us and they all loved it. And we outed them as a hoax. This is the rape board game. And these are the playing cards for the rape game. This is all back from 1994. That's what those specifically are, the extras. And here's the whole shebang. Cover by Nick Bugis. And he colorized basically all the artwork. Let's see if there's anything here. Can I show like a naked drawing of Andrea Dworkin? I'm not sure what the parameters are here. But Nick Bugis is Andrea Dworkin is. Yeah, here we go. Can we get that?
Just hold it up to the camera slowly.
There we go. There she is.
There's a lot of glare.
Too much light, yeah. But anyway.
Well, maybe that's for the best. This is a family show after all. Oh. If you perverts want to see Andrea Dworkin naked, you're just going to have to buy them.
No other place on earth you can get that.
I recommend that you do. I mean, my copy is in the mail, the esteemed Mr. Goat tells me, and I will be spending many, many evenings in my bunk with the picture of Andrea Dworkin naked. Okay. I'm just going to have to take a minute to purge that mental image out of my head. The things I do for this.
No, Nick's the maestro of ugliness. I mean, he's the best cartoonist of ugliness in world history, probably.
There is a lot of ugliness surrounding us. So the world is his canvas. What can I say? We have another $5 over on Odyssey from Hadrian Was Right. And he asks, does Jim have any thoughts about this Manson tier bloodbath in Idaho? I haven't heard of any Manson tier bloodbaths in Idaho, but Jim, have you?
Where was there? Somebody was in Colorado. There was some gay bar. Five people got killed last night, but I don't think this, not in Idaho, I don't think. Can they specify?
So Adrian, if you want your question answered, you're going to have to send.
Yeah, specify, because I'm not sure if I searched Manson tier bloodbath in Idaho, I'd get anything. So,
well, crazy things are always happening all around the world. It's probably something disgusting.
I did write a travelogue about Idaho. You can find it on Kindle. Spent a week up there and interviewed Michael A. Hoffman II. Whatever chances I get, I try to promote him. He's an unjustly ignored figure. That guy did a ton of work on Judaism and the Talmud. I mean, he wrote a book called Judaism, Strange Gods, which is like 2,000 pages. Expert on Masonic assassination conspiracies, white indentured servitude, and convict labor. And and this kind of dovetails with the J.D. Vance stuff. He's probably the most articulate writer about how the British royalty has historically shat upon and despised the English peasantry. That's how they wound up sending so many of them over here to work the plantations for profit. That's something I think is unaddressed in these circles, is the whole schism, the class schism. I know it conjures up Marxism, but if you trust your leaders or if you believe in monarchy, you should believe, I suppose, that they don't snuff out the peasants' lives at will, know that there's some kind of community there. And that's the great divide, I think. You know, we're all allegedly intellectuals, but my dad was a plumber, but the twain don't ever seem to meet. There's a lot of resentment, snobbery, elitism, hardly ever gets addressed. And that's what I wrote about the midterms. It's like everything has become cultural, left and right. Everything everyone was talking about was abortion and trannies and wokeness. No one was mentioning, hey, the hamburgers are $20 now. Or they vaguely would mention inflation, but we're going to get it down. But no one ever talked about how. And neither political party talks about economics at all. Having to scrape my whole life and having economics on the mind, I started to wonder why. I guess it seems like a distraction. Drag queen story hour. Yeah, not a fan, but I'm not sure that's the biggest problem facing everybody at this point. Not a popular opinion, I'm sure.
the thing is probably because they're not talking about economics because they agree on economics. I mean, what are Republicans what are they going to do so differently from the Democrats? I remember during the Tea Party era, it was all economics. Yeah, what's it? Or in the Clinton era, it's the economy, stupid, right? But over time, it would appear that either they don't have the power to control economic life in the country and the world, and you can maybe build an argument from that most of the time the economy is controlled from the Federal Reserve and from the Department of the Treasury and not from Congress. But you can also say that they don't care because they serve the same masters economically speaking.
Right, absolutely.
And there's no difference between them.
And the economic situation is so much worse now than it was during the Tea Party, at least if you gauge such things by debt. And, I mean, everyone's working four jobs if they want to, or they're on welfare. It's a whole mess, but I'd rather see those things solved than just about anything else. Because, okay, you've got one side screaming about intolerance and the other side screaming about degeneracy. It's like, I don't want $20 hamburgers. Can someone figure that out? Whatever your system is, I'd rather listen to that person. Trump, Trump from 2015 to about early 2017 when he bombed Syria, and I figured out he was not what he said he was. Nothing changed that I wanted to change. I don't remember any industry coming back to the U.S. I don't remember a wall being built. I don't remember. He said he was going to have the debt or eliminate the debt. Yeah, I think he added like $7 trillion. I know how defensive so many of you are, and it's the only hope for America. But sadly, as funny as he can be, and I always remember it was one of the first Republican primary debates with Rand Paul. He was on one end. Trump was on the other end. And Trump insulted the way one of them looked. And Rand Paul said, see, this is the way he insults the way people look. Trump leans over and is like, I never insulted the way you look. And trust me, there's a lot of material to work with there. That was great. But we don't need Don Rickles as a president. Over time, I started to kind of agree that he's a bit of a self-absorbed douchebag. And it was more about him than about...
People knew, I think, that he was a self-absorbed douchebag. But there was the glimmer of a hope that he is our douchebag.
In policy reflected that, as far as I can. I could be wrong, but nothing that I saw.
Right. Okay, I'm losing my train of thought. We are having a bunch of donations, but Hadrian has linked a story, and apparently four University of Ohio students have been killed in their beds in Moscow, Ohio, a city of about 26,000 people near the Idaho-Washington state border. And Moscow hasn't had a murder in about 5 years. Hadrian, if I'm being honest, this sounds like the plot to Twin Peaks to me. And I just hope that B.O.B. is not lurking in the woods.
I spent a night in Moscow during that travelogue, and it's an idyllic little town. That's kind of sad to hear, but increasingly frequent, eh? Mm.
It could be a serial killer, the article says, but I don't think we are.
Four at once? That would be a mass murderer, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
In their beds, so he probably got them while they were sleeping. There was blood on the walls. Really, when you have the time, the link is in the DLive and Odyssey chats. Just flick through the article. Really, really reminds me of the Twin Peaks plot, to be honest. So it's creepy. It's pretty creepy. I mean, I saw that because a lot of people in this movement love Twin Peaks, and it's okay. I get the appeal, but it just didn't work for me, I guess.
The only thing David Lynch has ever done that I liked was Eraserhead, and maybe because it's based on his time at the Philadelphia College of Art. There was something about Twin Peaks and everything else he's ever done that was really saturated with, look how clever I'm being. I mean, there are great film surrealists. I mean, Jodorowsky, Louis Buñuel, but I don't think David Lynch comes close to any of those people.
Jodorowsky, I would watch a lot of more Jodorowsky if Mrs. Gilby liked him, but she finds his style revolting for some reason. Yeah. So I have to watch him alone.
Yeah. You know?
As you get older, you no longer hide to play video games or watch porn, but to watch Alejandro Jodorowsky, which is...
I'm always fascinated with where people draw the line.
Right. So, okay, let's move on. There are some other donations. We have one from Aaron for $20 American over on Entropy, and he asks for Jim's thoughts about Trump's return to Twitter.
I guess it'll make it fun. I feel so poisoned with people arguing all the time. I mean, I've liked to argue my entire life until I realized it never gets you anywhere. Even if you win on every point, the other side never concedes. And it's tedious. I mean, people will be shitting themselves about Trump and he'll be pissing people off. And it'll be exactly like it was 7 years ago. Only the world is much worse than it was 7 years ago. Not that Trump was the cause of it, but I mean, the president, he should do, okay, you want to own the libs, fine, but can you do something concrete? And that's the problem. It's just an emblem of how degraded the society it is. The last two presidential elections, neither side that was declared the loser accepted the results. That's the sign. If you want to get into the minutia of, you know, which one was stolen, to what extent, that's a whole different thing. But the fact that no one trusts anyone anymore, I don't think there's a way back from that. It'll be fun, but I mean, how impaired is he at this point? Will he be as funny as he was 6 years ago? I'm not sure. He's fatter than he was 6 years ago. But I mean, this is what Mrs. Goad said. I don't know if you know about this, about the Santa,
right?
What's that?
Right. He's more institutional now. People have made this comment that he's no longer the plucky outsider. He's no longer the guy telling Rand Paul that's a lot of material. And trust me, there is a lot of material to mock about Rand Paul. No, now he's a Republican Party hack who's slightly ruder than the average MC.
And that's about it. Now, I just heard this last night from my tiny little wife. She said that DeSantis in Florida helped pass some kind of law where you can't criticize Israel or Jews, something real specific. Do you know about this? Is this just a rumor? Or because he's anti-woke, except...
I think it's a BDS law that the state will not do business with businesses which support the boycott, divest, and sanction movement against Israel.
That's an interesting political creature to me, the one they don't like. Muslims or gays or trannies or women or blacks or... Just don't mention Jews. Don't.
Right.
Ever mention? Did you? I'm sure you saw Dave Chappelle's monologue.
I didn't.
You didn't? Okay. I think he handled it better than just about any. I mean, Norm Macdonald, where he brought back from the dead, might have handled it just as well, but he handled it brilliantly and just about perfectly. But we're in this situation where
I don't know, Jim. I've always found Chappelle irritating, to be honest.
Okay.
How do I put this? When I was into stand-up comedy, I put on George Carlin's Last Thing, you know, It's Bad for You. Mm-hmm. And I have some very fond memories of watching that, you know, because I was young. I guess I was easily impressionable. But everything after that, every stand-up comedian, and this is not an endorsement of George Carlin. He's a disgusting shitlib, you know, one of the most openly anti-white people I've had the misfortune to listen to. And this is back in the 90s and early 2000s. He's been this radically anti-white, not like all of these Johnny-come-latelys to anti-whiteism. This guy has a visceral hatred of white people, and it shows.
Okay, a couple sample lines.
I will say this, just his comedic timing. the way that the whole package comes at you, the words, the mouth, the movements of the body. He does the whole body movements, right?
Yeah.
He does the funny little sounds. That just, I guess, broke me for every other comedian, just from the technical okay. side. I cannot find anyone else funny.
Some sample material. Chappelle comes out, he's announced, you know, they announce who's the musical guest, and he goes, first, I'd like to read from this prepared statement. He opens it up. He says, I oppose anti-Semitism in all its forms, and I stand in solidarity with the Jewish community. Then he folds it back, he puts it back in his pocket, and he goes, and that, Kanye, is how you buy yourself some time. And then he talked later, he said, when they're black, it's a gang. When they're Italian, it's a mob. When they're Jews, it's just a coincidence, and you're not allowed to talk about it. The other thing he said was, I've been to Hollywood, and I got to tell you, there's a lot of Jews. A lot. He said it just like that. And he said, like, it's not crazy to think that they control Hollywood. It's crazy to say it out loud. And I was just bold. I'm like, wow. And I think what I just read is that that's not the script that he told them he was going to. He just came out and surprised the hell out of them with that. And you can see some of the musicians, and they, as far as I could tell, there's darkness. They look Caucasian. They looked upset by what Dave said. But I thought he did a bang-up job with that, just that material. But we're at the point where, like, I mean, what happened to Kanye and Kyrie Irving, and Chappelle's pretty much seems bulletproof, but it's very sad that you have to have the black dudes.
Nobody is bulletproof, really, not with that subject. I'm reminded, I don't know if you've seen that film, V for Vendetta. We were discussing it last show with Huitgeert, right? Mm-hmm. We were also discussing the comic, which is vastly superior to the film. But in the film, they have this incident where a comedian, just like Chappelle, throws out the censor-approved script and writes a new one in the morning, right, just before filming. And he thinks he's just going to have to do some boring fundraiser to apologize, you know, for this new and edgy script. But he ends up in the gulag and shot, because it's what happens when you go off script and you actually insult power. Power does not like being mocked. Chappelle's not going to come out of this unscathed. I don't think anyone's big enough to resist organized Jewry in America without making some serious sacrifices. Now, what I liked about Kanye West is that he has made some serious sacrifices and he's still standing up. Well, we're going to see Chappelle's staying power, or, you know, to draw a boxing analogy, Chappelle's punches may have been stronger than Kanye's, but can he take it on the chin and keep going? Does he have the heart to keep going? This is what makes a boxer. Anyone can hit hard, but not everyone can go the distance.
Okay, one thing I respected, he had this net. What was it? Netflix. He had a cable show for two seasons. HBO, one of the most successful comedy series of all time. He walked away from what I think at the time was the most lucrative deal in TV history. For matters of conscience, he never really got into it, but he said they wanted him to change and tone down certain things, and he didn't. He survived the huge tranny thing. He did. He had a special about a year ago and survived that. And the Netflix, everyone was going to walk out. He's punched at Jews who are the Jews of Jewry and trannies who are the Jews of sexuality. Still has, I mean, maybe, you know, they put some plutonium in his beer or something. Like, something's going to happen to him. But for the time being, knock on wood, you know, hope springs eternal. Like, he's still stand and impenitent. I was really impressed with the bravery of, like, the way he did that. Just, you know, about the whole Patton Oswalt, and they said Nick was this notorious cartoonist. I've shared this story before. Patton Oswalt, and I think when his wife died, I think something broke inside the guy. I knew him for a long time. We've never had a falling out, but we drifted apart. He can't talk to me because of who I am. But when BuzzFeed did that article saying Nick was the cartoonist, Patton Oswalt, the week after, and he was getting tons of flack for this. We all went out to dinner, and he took a picture of Nick. He had me take a picture of him and Nick, and he put it up on Twitter. That, to me, was brave, too. I'm surprised he didn't get canceled for that. And I guess when they do have something to lose, it's more impressive than when they don't. So, I mean, people are so cowed these days. When anybody shows a glimmer of bravery, it's exciting.
Indeed. Now, we have another donation, and I think that answers Aaron's question. We have another donation from ABC for 10 American dollars. And 40 minutes into the show, I guess we're going to have to discuss what we came here to discuss, because ABC says, I wouldn't spit on her ass if her guts were on fire, because family's the only thing that means a goddamn. You'll learn. Smack your head and your ass together. Scenes from the movie Hillbilly Elegy. Yeehaw. There is a simple, certain simple and honest charm associated with that culture. And we are here, Jim, to discuss J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy. Now, I trust you've had the chance to read the book once again for the show, refresh your memory, but you did a review of it a long time ago. And it's a book in which now Senator J.D. Vance, although at the time he's just a 31-year-old lawyer from a, you know, Cincinnati, who for some reason has been given a national platform to talk about his hillbilly culture, basically describes his time growing up in Middletown, Ohio, and Jackson, Kentucky, where his family, they're Scotch-Irish, they're hillbillies, and they're dysfunctional.
Violent, heroin addicted.
But they also are, you know, proud and fierce and independent and all these positive things.
Well, what I wrote about in the it was considered this visionary, this breakthrough book, because he portrayed these people as human. And that's how sad it was in 2018 that's a breakthrough. Well, you know, half of the country is human. Wow. But like that, and that's a landmark. But yeah, he grew, I mean, for a time he had a real, I'm not sure what happened to his mom. She fell out of the picture. His meemaw, his grandmother, who was a heroin addict, but was fiercely protective of him, raised him. Somehow the family made it up to an industrial part of Southern Ohio. But he ruled out that genetics had anything to do with it, because he and his sister pried themselves out of this hillbilly hellhole and made something of themselves. He ruled out that it was industrial or deindustrialization, globalism, which to me, that's the main obvious culprit. I don't care how, I mean, you could come from the finest bloodline. Try growing up there in those hills and hollers of Kentucky when there's nothing there but meth and moonshine and maybe a gas station. See how you do. I'd really like to see that sort of leveling at some point, just maybe as a TV show. But his conclusion was that, yeah, they're human, but they're bad humans. There was no other explanation to him. Couldn't be that their trust, their sense of belonging to a country was gradually eroded. Anything else, it just, they were bad people and they made bad decisions. That's what I disliked. And he married a Hindu woman and went to Yale, and he said things which pleased the coastal elites. I'm not sure, I guess in Ohio voted him in, but he was against Tim Ryan. So was it close? I don't even know how close it was, but I'd like to hear what he's going to do for the people who are strung out on opioids and strung out on Adderall. That was my last article for, I was shocked. Methamphetamine and cocaine overdoses outnumbered prescription opioids and heroin overdoses last year in America. No one's talking about that. But yeah, I mean, if he has a plan, I'd like to hear it. If it's just he's like this beaver looking guy that makes people feel good, that's someone that Trump, then it's meaningless to me.
That's interesting. I wouldn't say he says that hillbillies are bad people, but he does lay the blame for their predicament squarely at their feet. And he goes at it with this, I guess by now we should be recognizing it as the typical civic nationalist center-right appeal to personal responsibility. You hear it from Jordan Peterson. You hear it from, well, take your pick, whomever the center-right decides to use as their go-to intellectual at the time. He's always droning on about personal responsibility. You are in control of your life. You are this, you are that. However, I mean, you look at the facts of life beyond just the facts of hillbillies, just the facts of life from your own life growing up. And I've written about this actually, and it's one of, I think, relative to the impact, to the importance of what I'm trying to convey, is one of my most ignored articles, is that just how little of our lives is under our control, just how much of it is, firstly, the product of our genetics, secondly, the product of our birth, which we do not choose, Thirdly, the product of our circumstance. So, for example, if, you know, there are kids in Ukraine right now who are not going to have good lives through no fault of their own, a missile fell on
them. Well, they should just pull themselves up by their bootstraps.
Well, see, that's the trick, Jim. They're not going to wear boots because they don't have legs.
Right. That's a problem in these online discussions or in just human thinking in general. It's just a one size fits all, or it's all genetic, or it's all nature. It's hopelessly complicated. And the times in my life where I've taken responsibility, things have gone better, but I still haven't stopped immigration. I haven't stopped the national debt. There are things that are completely out of your control. And is that defeatist? It's realistic. After 61 years, it's like voting has never done anything for me. I've never personally sanctioned where $1 that they take out of my taxes goes. So, I mean, enjoy it. Enjoy the sporting element of it, I guess. And if it makes you feel warm to get immersed in this endless cycle of outrage, keep going. But I guess I'd rather just stay in propaganda and philosophy and talking about where they're lying, because that'll have an effect on some people. Appeals to emotion, I'm going to hold that out for someone else who really wants to peddle that bullshit. I'm bothered in an autistic sense by what they're selling people is a pack of lies, and people are getting hurt as a result of it. And that's where I enter and exit.
You know how to read between the lines. Vance more or less gives you all the information you need to deduce where the decline of the hillbilly community really starts. It's with deindustrialization in the 70s and 80s. He describes
it was also industrialization, because I write about this in the Redneck book. The hillbillies were a lot of, especially in those areas, Kentucky and West Virginia, those were border states, and those mountain feuds, they were the residue of Union and rebel soldiers, but they had this entire way of life, living, scraping out an existence after indentured servitude in the hills for a good, 150 years, generations after generations. But then the coal companies came in, uprooted them from the land, put them in these little shacks, had them work for scrip, you owe your soul to the company store, work them to death, essentially like sharecropping, but in coal mines. In World War I, statistically, you were likelier to die in a West Virginia coal mine than on the battlefields of World War I in Europe. And once they got sufficient coal, they just left, and they completely they broke up these communities, decimated them. And you want to be depressed, drive through Appalachia these days. You go a creekside in the winter when there's no vegetation. There are used dryers and toilet paper hanging from the trees. These are the most destitute people in America, and it's especially the CivNats that kind of sneer at these type of people, who I'd like to force to live there for a while and see how they fare. Because the people who, maybe I'm sure genetics has something to do with it. Maybe the brains did move out for a better, but those people are tough. Those are some of the toughest people. I remember I was driving through the highways, they're chiseled through coal. There are walls of coal on either side of it. Some roadside, he was selling little yarn trinkets. And like, what's your name, fella? He's like, Hayes Hatfield. His name was Hayes, which is a hillbilly. But he was, the Hatfield clan. You're on that side of West Virginia. It's Hatfield Diner. Then it's McCoy Chevrolet if you cross the river. Those are some of the salt of the earthiest people I've ever seen. But they're completely disconnected from the power structure. A week ago, when the midterms were happening, me and the missus took a little vacation up the Georgia mountains. I'm sitting there and all my white privilege and my urban privilege in a hot tub looking at the leaves changing over the hills. And you see some of these people up there. This is deliverance country. These are hard bitten people, hundreds of years, and they're isolated. And I'm thinking these people are truly more cut off from the power structure than any black guy living in Atlanta. And what's the best they have to vote for in this? Herschel Walker, the most mentally impaired politician perhaps of all time. I'm not sure if you saw I'm going to write about it in the worst way.
More impaired than Fetterman up in Pennsylvania.
I think, yeah, he just did this and was only about 10 miles from where I live. If I had known Herschel Walker was going to be speaking, I would have gone. But this extended thing about how werewolves can kill vampires, and he wants to become a werewolf because they're better than vampires. But the vampire was pretty cool. And And it was just absolutely incoherent. I think, yeah, Fetterman may say something backwards every once. I don't think he's as impaired as Herschel Walker is. But this is that's the great white hope for the hillbillies of northern Georgia.
Well, if we're being technical with the mythology, no, werewolves cannot kill vampires, and they rarely cross paths in folklore. Can people forget that vampires were not invented by Bram Stoker? They are a feature of the folklore of the vampire nation, of the vampire, the Balkan.
He wasn't
nations.
Talking about ancient European folklore. He was talking about Fright Night, some movie from the 80s. That's how he started. I was watching this movie, Fright Night, Freak Night, or something.
I'm always annoyed at this notion that werewolves are going to kill vampires. The only.
Take it up.
I guess I'm a Macedonian folklore purist, but the only thing that can kill a vampire is a vampiroglu, and that's a composite term. Oglu is a Turkish word meaning son of, and so what happens is when a man becomes a vampire, usually because he's buried improperly or in unconsecrated ground, or the priest is drunk, which happens more often than you think, he can become a vampire. And what he does is he does not drink blood, but he gets up and rapes the women at night. He lays down on top of them, paralyzing them, and rapes them. And if he rapes his own wife, and he's going to rape his widow, and it's usually the vampires will first go for the widow, he can impregnate her, and her son will be a vampiroglu, right? A son of a vampire. And
look
he
at
has
how much
the
more
distinction
lore.
Of being able to see the vampire, because the vampire is invisible.
So you're much more qualified, just with your knowledge of vampiric folklore, you're much more qualified to be a U.S. senator from Georgia than this guy is, which is...
Obviously. I mean, if we are facing literal pot-belly vampire goblins, you're going to need someone who knows a thing or two about vampires to fight them. And I don't think your Herschel Walker guy knows a thing or two about vampires. But that is my position on vampire folklore. I mean, I respect the fan fiction which Mr. Stoker wrote, but vampires are a serious problem here in the Balkans. I would not like people to walk away with improper vampire advice.
Oh, it's infuriating.
Get back to Mr. Vance. And there is, of course, that whole approach to. You know what your problem is? It's your attitude. And he does give concessions that he got very lucky personally, that he had his Maymaw and Paypaw to rescue him from basically becoming another hillbilly strung out on opioids. But there's always that thing about, oh, they're feeling sorry for themselves. They're blaming the government. They're blaming Obama. They're blaming this. They're blaming that. Whereas we are tracking a population, which, I mean, we know from David Hackett Fisher's Albion Seed, they have been essentially white identified slaves since before they came from America. Right. The hillbillies are transplants from the border area between Scotland and England. This is why they're called the Scotch-Irish, because some of them migrated to Ulster and then to America. So this is a very ancient population. And this, because this is the borderland between England and Scotland, this was a war-torn region of the British Isles up until the Acts of Union, and you know, extending a little bit into that, because some of the feuds, you mentioned the Civil War, some of them extend back to the last Jacobite Rising, or even before that, before the Acts of Union, wars between England and Scotland before Union. So this is a population which has been on the receiving end of war and desolation and just being cut off from the political structure, because neither of the lords of either England or Scotland could realistically hold the land. They had zero attachment to these people, and so they did not invest in the land. And
it's just hopelessly reductive to say it's all about their attitude. Attitude has, I mean, yeah, that has a lot to do with everything. When I've improved my attitude, my life has improved, but there are things, like you said, that are out of your control. And yeah, you picked up that these are people that have been cut off from the power structure far more than, I mean, we had this
for
behemoth,
longer than America's existed.
This chocolate hippo, gap-toothed Stacey Abrams. almost became the governor here. It's like, you know, Georgia is not sending its finest to Georgia. They're scraping like Herschel Walker, Stacey Abrams, and the white guy, the governor, Brian Kemp. He's just this bland cardboard sheet. And Warnock, who's this radical black preacher, he preaches. He's the current senator, but he's where he's at MLK's church, Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta. Can't they find four better Georgians than that? Or are they deliberately choosing like ones just to rub our noses in? I'm not sure.
Indeed. It is. We're, of course, you're mentioning Georgia because you're familiar with it. Appalachia is a very big place. I mean, you look at it on a map. Some, by some definitions, it even stretches into New Hampshire, into those mountains.
Maine,
over
yeah.
There.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of hill folk in America. They're a very large contingent of the population. And yeah, people have been commenting in chat that they are disproportionately represented in the American military. And J.D. Vance was also in the military. He was a Marine, although he was, from what I understood, he was like Private Joker in Full Metal Jacket. He was not...
Bullied. Hmm? Bullied, and I mean, he was just a...
No, that's Gomer Pyle. That's the fat
guy. Okay.
Joker is the guy who goes on to become
glasses.
A journalist.
Okay.
Right? A military journalist. So he was like a PR representative for his army base or something. He was writing a desk,
a book called Hillbilly Land that came out in the early 90s. It was about depictions of hillbillies in cinema. And they talked about Sergeant York, Alvin York, who was a World War One hero, and how, yeah, the fighting men of the U.S. disproportionately have been Southerners and Hill Southerners, which is ironic because they really don't get much from the U.S. I'm not sure how long, and the U.S., the military at this point has become so woke, it's frightening. I think you have active black gang members. Apparently, there's a brewing race war within the U.S. military. It's all very tiresome and depressing. Holidays are coming up, though. Do you celebrate any version of Thanksgiving in Macedonia or
no?
Nothing?
I mean, we do have, because these things ultimately anchor all the way back to the Indo-European solar cycle. We do have, late November or mid-November holidays. Let me just think. There's the Feast of Saint Dimitri, which is my family's feast, and it's a big deal somewhat, but it's more a private affair than although Thanksgiving is a private and family affair in America too, right?
Yeah, for the most part, you bring friends over and just eat yourself into a coma.
Yeah, that's Saint Dimitri, right?
I mean, I'm so affected by cold and dark weather. My hunch is that Halloween and Thanksgiving and Christmas are designed to soothe you somewhat before you go into the really dark months in January and February, where nothing but the Super Bowl happens, at least here. But I had an article about 10 years ago called Diary of an Expatriate Ice Person. I believe that maybe it was technological superiority had something to do with maybe the wandering Nordic spirit. But I think the main reason, at least my ancestors who had anything to do with conquering the equatorial nations, was for the better weather. That might be the best excuse for white colonialism, is like some warmth.
Yeah, I mean, I have this idea, of course, that the reason why the loss of California is such a profound defeat for the white race is because California is the land of endless summer, and this is where it should have ended for us, right? Instead, we went into the extra innings, and now we're going to see white civilization and the white race being deconstructed in real time. We get to live through it, though, Mr. Goad, and I guess that's all the consolation we're ever going to need.
When COVID first started happening, then the riots, and everyone was sure the world was ending. And it occurred to me, like, everyone knows they're going to die. Everyone knows that the world's going to end, but no one thinks, you know, it's going to happen in their lifetime. But apparently it's happening as we speak. And I'm sort of impressed with how much everyone has kept it together. I wrote an article about that about a year ago, and maybe it's some learned helplessness, or maybe they're just holding out. You know, the depression, from what I've seen, evolution-wise, when the elephant can't find a mate, he gets depressed and he stores his resources. Depression serves that you don't expend too much energy trying to flex or lift. maybe depression is just we're just, you know, hibernating a little bit, and then there's going to be mass psychosis. I'm not sure. But I was impressed that the Muslim terrorists, after 9/11, they pretty much cooled it. I'm surprised there hasn't been more mayhem over these last 2 years, because they've been the craziest I've seen in my lifetime.
Well, I guess when people have a why they can bear anyhow, I mean, we know, like we see from Ukraine that Russia has basically destroyed the energy infrastructure of that country. It's November in Northern Europe, right? No heating, no light, no nothing. And people are still keeping it together over in Ukraine because they have a why. What why keeps Americans going? I don't know. I'm not going to get into. What why keeps me going? White identitarianism. It's fraying at the edges a little bit, but it keeps me going for the time being. So I guess that answers our question. It's amazing what people can do under immense duress, under immense pressure. How we can survive. We are a tough people. We are a tough creatures, aren't we, human beings? Especially white human beings. We are very resilient.
I'm going to get into the generational thing. A lot of these kids seem so intensely weak to me. And I think there's documented lower testosterone. But, I mean, we had no such thing as microaggressions when we were kids. Maybe it's petering out or something, but whatever it is, late stage capitalism right before the collapse of everything, you know, the decadence, whatever. But people, you know, the generations before me were much stronger than our generation. So I don't want to insult you by including you in our generation, but I think humans have gotten progressively weaker. And maybe that's just robots can do all the heavy lifting. So there's not much genuine need for masculinity out there. That maybe that's why culture in general is becoming emasculated, is physical strength's not needed.
Evolution, and maybe it's evolution at work, because that's the thing. All of these very masculine traits, like, you know, bulging biceps and the bone structure of, oh, I'm a Chad, they take up resources, right? And someone who has been a bodybuilder, someone who has tried to look intimidating and masculine, it takes up a lot of resources in terms of food and investment, you know, energy, time to look like that, or to even begin looking like that, you know, buff. And those are resources you're not putting towards other things. Now, if there is very little utility towards masculinity, then nature is just going to select against it. This is how, for example, flightless birds lost their ability to fly. Just the ability to fly was never important, was not no longer important to these species. Right. And because big, wide wings are an investment, they take up energy, birds which did not expend energy on wings survive better. So you get ostriches, so you get penguins, you get chickens, birds, which survive quite fine without being able to fly. This is how animals lose organs during the evolutionary processes. This is how we and our great ape cousins lost our tails. There's just no longer utility to tails, so we don't need them, so we shed them, right? No longer expending resources on them.
Never seen a rendering of an alien or a futuristic creature that looks macho. Let's put it that way. They're just these eggs on toothpicks, basically.
And we have Dino Legovich over on Odyssey saying testosterone decline. Yes, there is a testosterone decline, Dino, for $3. Thank you for that, Dino. But we're trying to get into the question of why there is a testosterone decline, right? We understand that there is. We observe it.
Yeah, I did an article about
levels. We observe it in people's physiognomy and behavior.
Yeah,
but we got to ask ourselves why this is taking place. And this is something that Vance comments on, that essentially, if you try to live with the hillbillies' honor culture in the modern world, well, the only word to describe it right now is to be an asshole. He describes this incident where someone, an asshole, cut him off on the freeway and flipped him off. And all of his instincts are telling him, you know, I should overtake this guy at the next stop get out of the car and beat the shit out of him. And I sympathize with him because I've been cut off on the freeway too. And I used to, I fantasize about taking a length of pipe to the guy's vehicle when he does that to me. But if you do that, they put you in prison. That's a problem. That's a problem. Masculinity, and this is that's an extremely masculine type of outburst. You're defending your honor as a driver, sure, which should never be in it's being actively selected against, but not just by our society, but society as such. Being civilized means sometimes eating your pride, swallowing your pride,
right? Yeah.
And not engaging in these types of honor conflicts. But hillbilly society runs on this conception of honor.
Yeah, absolutely. The article I wrote about 10 years ago was called Our Balls Ourselves, and the title was a parody of Our Bodies Ourselves, some feminist handbook that was famous in the early 70s. But at the time, 10 years ago, globally, testosterone levels and sperm counts had plummeted by about 75% over the previous century, which is insane. And I'm sure it's much worse now, but yeah, maybe nature is selecting against masculinity because it's not really necessary anymore. We've got machines that can do more than 1,000 men. That's really sad because it's fun being masculine. It's fun chasing down someone who's cut you off in traffic and knocking them out with one punch. it's glorious. And I think that was the worst thing about going to prison is I'm not allowed to act that way anymore. I've been seething about that for like 20 years. I'm a notorious hothead, and I've taken it, made it physical many, many times. But the entanglements, I mean, yeah, the pleasure is fantastic, but it's a fleeting pleasure. And then you have to deal with 10 years staring at a wall. So, and well, I guess I think, you know,
they
get
it out of me in elementary school because I don't know, I'm reading this and I can relate to it, even though I come from a very different background than Mr. Vance, because yeah, people insulted me and my family's honor in elementary school and I kicked the shit out of them. But then you get sent to detention. You get sent to a psychologist. Why? Because, well, you're violent.
Because that's of what? The science? Nice. Yeah. Hmm? Because
you're showing warning signs for things like that. And you get the message pretty soon as a young man that, well, being masculine is just not accepted in our society. And I have a lot of people, including friends of this show, saying things about plastics and estrogen.
Yeah, plastics. Yeah. BPAs. Whatever.
And I'm sure that's a factor, but something that you learn studying biology, the primary method of change is selection. Right. Generational. We're talking about generational change. Guys who were tough in the 80s are still tough today. They're older, so their testosterone is lower, obviously, but they're still tough and masculine. Guys who were soft in the 90s, they're soft today. Right. Even though the saturation with plastic is probably 1,000-fold increase or something. I think that the factor between testosterone drop is selection pressure. Selection pressure. If we're going to have a biological worldview, we're going to have to learn those words, selection pressure. We are selecting against those men who are high in testosterone and masculine and have this notion of honor and of using violence to protect honor. And we are selecting for those men who have no such notion, who have no such instinct, and who are basically tame. And I'm not going to see... Maybe a month or two or three ago, I would have said that's a bad thing because I am a guy who likes to fight and who likes to defend my honor. However, I am prepared to accept the notion that the very idea of civilization might select against such men. This is something we must be prepared to accept. And I know that this show is listened to disproportionately by masculine men, but we got to start thinking about this.
It dovetails a little bit with my most recent article about Adderall, because I found it's statistically significant. 2 to 4 times as many boys were prescribed it as girls, and like 1.6 times as many men as women. When you think about what attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is, it's not a disease. There's no etiology, or I'm not sure how you pronounce that word. It's only diagnosed via the behaviors that manifest when you supposedly have this condition. So it's entirely socially constructed. It's impulsivity or rambunctiousness or oppositional defiance. These are all fundamentally male traits. Those are the guys who become explorers and inventors. There's a society selecting against that, and you're getting punished. It's decided socially, well, here's the line. Everyone gets distracted a little. Everyone talks back a little bit, but if you talk back to where you're acting like this rebellious guy rather than a compliant woman who believes everything authority tells her, we're going to medicate you. That's so sad. I think there's like an anti-male agenda in prescribing Adderall to make these little boys behave. Maybe they get bored. Maybe they'd rather out be like digging up rocks and playing with worms. Maybe that's part of, I mean, it's schools. What, like 80% of grade schools teachers are female? And I guess the rest are gay males and transgender. It's crazy. We're raising males entirely by women and with female values.
It doesn't really, I mean, sure, the presence of women is a factor, but ultimately we are in a situation where these very notions of masculinity are being stamped out of the especially white human being. And we've spoken about this before on this show, that the end state is probably China. The Chinese, Asians in general, but the Chinese especially, are profoundly unmasculine. They, Chinese men are lacking in masculinity, Korean men as well, to a lesser degree, because in Korea, war is still a pressing reality, so they can't really afford to stamp masculinity out. But the every Chinese man I've met has been depressingly effeminate, right? The Japanese are a more mixed bag, but you know how it goes. And that they have been civilized for far longer than we have, right? Maybe that's us in the future. Maybe this compliance they have, it's not even compliance, it's just this soulless materialism. We call it compliance, but they're not really loyal to the Chinese Communist Party. They are afraid of punishment and they seek reward, and the Chinese Communist Party is the fount of punishment and reward. So it's a minor nuance, but important.
These things happen organically a lot of the times. I mean, policy determines it a lot of times, but for the most part, I think that's the vanity of propagandists and writers and pundits to think that if you just get the right message across most forcefully, you'll change the course of history. You might have absolutely no influence over it all, which is depressing if you've spent your entire life thinking it makes a difference, but I guess it's better than just banging your head against the wall for the rest of your life. Once you realize propaganda only can accomplish so much. Not sure why I'm getting choked up all of a sudden. Not choked up, but scratchy throat. Let me get a...
Gotta be the airborne plastics. Drink some chaga.
It's probably all the... I could smell the ink from these thousands of books that I have in this room currently.
Right. Like, are you going to be like George Costanza's fiancé and choke on your own ink?
Yeah, I actually thought about that. Yeah,
that was one of the greatest things. Books.
You've seen the scene where he's informed of her death, and he just says, "Huh." Possibly my favorite moment in TV comedy history. We have any more questions?
Right. Let's check out. We've been having so much fun over here chatting and gabbing away. I forgot to check the questions. Oh yeah. There's another one from ABC for another 10 American dollars. Thank you, sir. We have this week, 4 days ago, in his announcement speech, Trump said that if elected, he will seek the death penalty for drug dealers and human traffickers, minute 48 to 52 in his speech. Interesting combination, master move. Do you think he'll win? Do you think he should win? Let's see Jim's thoughts on
so this. He's going to jail the Sacklers? Who are the drug dealers? It's all semantic, isn't it? And, I mean, does Donald Trump Jr. go to prison? That guy is so obviously coked out all the time. Who was the guy in the Philippines? Duterte? He said he was going to kill or just throw them into the sharks in Manila Bay. And I think that's how he got elected. That seems a bit... a bit much. I mean, one of the most compelling arguments in favor of drugs I ever heard was some UCLA pharmacologist. He said that, you know, throughout history, like the coca leaf and all these natural drugs were used well and beneficially by societies. It all depends on the dosage. The problem is they're now purified, they're synthetic, they're way beyond what we're able to handle. And I agree with that. The use of illicit drugs has plummeted since I was a kid. And what happened was, it seems like the big pharma's like, well, we're just going to deal all the coke and all the coke, meth and heroin ourselves. So they put out Oxycontin and Adderall. They're just cornering the market. So it's all semantic. They're still dealing drugs, but legally. And they're throwing all the mom and pop drug dealers out is what's going on. Basically. It's basically like the Walmartization of drug dealing.
Yeah, this is a natural tendency in all businesses towards centralization, towards corporatization and proceduralization. Drug dealing is never going to be as fun as it was in the 1980s. Yes. There's not going to be another Pablo Escobar. See, that's the thing, right? There's this great show, Narcos, right? I like it. It's, you know, Netflix. But it's interesting because they show the progression in the original Narcos from Pablo Escobar, who runs the drug trade out of Colombia through Miami, right? And Pablo Escobar is not the kind of person you forget. He's bombastic. He wields personal power. He's personally charismatic. He's got great ambitions. He wants to be president of Colombia or whatever. And then he's replaced, when he's killed in the third season, he's replaced with the Cali cartel, right? These guys are sleek. They're corporate. They rely not so much on personal charisma and intimidation, but on surveillance and ruthless murderous efficiency, right? So it's the corporatization of drug dealers, but these guys are still cartel, right? Mm-hmm. Now you've taken it to the other step where it's basically Purdue Pharma and GlaxoSmithKline and Bayer Pharmaceuticals and all of these wonderful companies selling legal drugs so people can get legally fucked up. You know, invent having a disease, or they have a disease invented to them. So you're, right, you're fucked up on amphetamines because you're a young yet rambunctious kid. Or, you know, since we're talking about hillbillies, hillbilly heroin, OxyContin, which has been imposed on Appalachia, which I'm sure some people would like to say, well, you should just pull yourself out of heroin addiction by your bootstraps. Or OxyContin, after you were lied to about the addictivity of this drug, mind you.
And I wonder at least how much of it is just a deliberate pacification program. I'm not sure what happened with the opium wars in China, but my understanding is the British used opium to pacify the Chinese population. I think that's what's going on. I think Kaczynski mentioned this about antidepressants. They're creating intolerable situations that any sane person 1,000 years ago would have rebelled against, but they're cutting us off at the pass by doping everyone up and stupid distractions and the left-right imaginary divide. These are social constructs. Everyone's at each other's throats. We're not a functional society anymore. I'm not sure what else to say about it, but that's what's insidious about the legal drugs is, and it happened with my brother. It's okay because a doctor's prescribing them the morphine and the OxyContin and the antidepressants and the muscle relaxers and the anti-dizziness and the anti-anxiety and the the sleep medicine, the Ambien, all at once. So it's okay. Doesn't matter if he's only awake 3 hours a day and doesn't do anything. That's crazy. But it's legal. And I think that I'd rather them go back to illicit drug dealing. So at least there's the implication it's not good for you.
Norse Nature in the chat points out that up until 1909, all the currently illegal drugs were legal in America. And there was not so much of a problem, you know. There was not all these problems, all this fear around drugs. I recently remember reading a reprint of a Madison Grant essay over in Countercurrents where he basically talks about the coca leaf and how essentially it is the traditional stimulant of the Andes. And he says, indeed, it is impossible to work in the Andes without chewing a little coca. And, you know, for all of our neuroticism about drugs, our society is fucked up on drugs all the time. I myself am fucked up on coffee most of the time. I'm not proud of it, but I'm addicted to the bean water. I'm strongly addicted to it. No. It's probably the only mind-altering substance I consume on a regular basis. I mean, sometimes I haven't had alcohol in a long time though. And it's something I think about. Look, as a guy who just drinks coffee, I think I may be in the minority right now. There's a lot of people out there taking antidepressants, anti-anxiety medicine, painkillers, amphetamines, and I broached this subject with Blair Cottrell when he was the guest on the show, and we're gonna come back to the question of mental illness with Blair Cottrell when he returns on the show. It's already in the cards, folks. But I think that the modern world is so unnatural that it may be impossible to cope with it unless you're fucked up on something. And I remember that I was having a very difficult time de-stressing when I had an office job, when I came back home. And one of the, one of the warning signs of alcoholism is you start drinking because you can't cope. So you start drinking every day to de-stress. And so I'm just monitoring my own body, my own mental states. And I realized, holy shit, I'm slowly becoming addicted to alcohol. So I start periodically having these periods where I just don't drink anything at all because I'm really afraid. I have an addictive personality by nature, by genetics. Another one of those things you can't really control. Mm-hmm. Unless you are like me and have this insane habit of just monitoring your own moods at all times, which is something I learned over long periods of time, you can get caught up in these addictions very easily.
Well, Kaczynski's entire argument about antidepressants was that, and it starts off, and I almost know it word for word, imagine a world that creates conditions are so intolerable that people are given a drug just so they can cope. I mean, if you get depressed, I don't believe in chemical depression, and most people that get antidepressants aren't tested for any kind of chemical imbalance. But antidepressants are designed to make you tolerate situations that you naturally, in your natural sane state, would find intolerable. That's insidious. That's crazy. I've known so many people on antidepressants. They all seem like they need it, but they admit that they're depressed. They admit that they're more depressed. The scary thing is that, like a zombie, everyone, I need it. There's something in that drug. What they get addicted to is thinking they need it. It's crazy. But yeah, the drug will just say no. And that was the big thing, Nancy Reagan in the 80s, just say no. That's when the pharmaceutical companies hadn't cornered the illicit drug market like they do now.
As someone who has been bullied by a psychiatrist into taking antidepressants in the past, my experience with it is they don't take the depression away, the emptiness of it all, right? Because depression is not so much feeling sad, it's feeling empty. Mm-hmm. You don't feel, which is a problem. But they do take away the physical symptom, which is sometimes described as leaden limbs, right? You have lead in your limbs. It's very difficult to move. You don't want to move. You don't want to get out of bed, realistically speaking. Some people are so depressed they cannot leave the bed even to go to the bathroom. Those are very difficult pathological cases. And there's other physical symptoms of depression. They're not pretty, but once you take them all away and not take away the psychological state, which the drugs do not do, mm-hmm. you're actually in a very dangerous place where people are still feeling like crap or worse, not feeling anything at all. But now they have the energy to do things. And this is why they are associated with increased suicide risk, because suicide is an act. Depression mm-hmm. depresses you. You don't act, right? So maybe it goes away on its own. Maybe you need to think or talk to your through your problems. But the physical depression is there to keep you from doing something stupid to yourself.
I believe
there is an evolutionary psychology explanation for the physical symptoms. That's what you find really scary about yourself when you're on these drugs is, the zombie is a good description. There's nothing inside me. I am empty. I'm unfeeling. I'm in this dark, cold ocean, and nobody's coming to get me. But I feel fine otherwise. And that's uncanny valley.
Did antidepressants for about 2 months in jail when I was facing 25 years in prison. And the creepiest, nothing about it was good. It was Paxil that they put me on. I had the creepiest feeling that some invisible hand was holding me by the scruff of the neck, that I was being controlled. And when I went off them, I felt my consciousness opening up again and my agency opening up again, like when your sinuses are clearing after you've had a cold. But again, I believe that neuroscience will solve most of human mysteries. I think the problem is we're nowhere near that, and they're jumping the gun, and the profit margin is making, you know, everything becomes a disorder because you can make money selling pills for it. That's the problem. I don't think we know nearly enough to be that reckless with pharmaceuticals at this point.
Indeed. We have a hundred, that's actually a diamond from Norse Nature of Rondeel Ivan. He asks, old-time Appalachian bluegrass opinions?
What, like Bill Monroe who else? Del McCoury. Really hard to play. Very, very specifically white music. There's nothing black about bluegrass and the music from the hills of Kentucky and West Virginia. Sounds a little whiny to me. That's about it. I'm much more of a fan of like 60s honky tonk with that huge, lush Nashville sound. When white Americans, like middle Americans, were finally being recognized by popular culture. I remember it was, I think, Time or Newsweek. They had a picture of Merle Haggard and the country music, the working man's music. That's the stuff. I mean, bless them and keep them, the people that play the music from the hills. It's a little too far from my experience and it's just, it's too trebly, I think. I think that there's not enough bass in it for me, but no objections to it. I mean, if you like Blue Moon of Kentucky or any of that stuff, fantastic.
Right. I'm going to take your word for it, Jim, because I have an inkling that you're the expert on these questions.
Yeah, to some degree. And here's a recommendation I'll make, and you can get it all across the world. And it's 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Standard Time on Saturdays, WMBR.org. It's in Cambridge, Massachusetts, MIT's college radio station. 10 to noon Eastern Time Saturdays, show called Backwoods. Phenomenal DJ. You listen to this, you realize the Beatles ruined everything. This is all the best country, bluegrass, rockabilly, blues, soul music from the 50s and 60s. Tremendous music. And best DJ in the world, too. But yeah, the Beatles, I did a whole podcast episode a few years ago. I think the Beatles ruined much more than people blame them for. Those were the first four guys that were aggressively non-masculine pop culture heroes. I mean, Elvis Presley had sex appeal, but the Beatles were these deballed, lovable. They wanted to hold your hand, not rape you or at least have sex with you. Beatles, it all started with the Beatles, or it accelerated with the Beatles.
Right. It's interesting. You think about it, you think about how they were surrounded by this aura of sex, but you look at a picture of John Lennon, he does not message sex, not even the infamous picture of him and him wrapped naked around Yoko Ono.
Fetal position, right.
Right. Yeah. That's not sexy. In any way.
Compare that to Jerry Lee Lewis, who was an absolute maniac. That guy captured it. I mean, the real raw feral spirit better than anything that came after him. And he sadly passed, and we still have Paul McCartney.
Right. Well, it's, I guess the good always die young. I was just
saying. No, he was like 87 or Jerry Lee Lewis, like. Yeah, I mean, he peaked in the late 50s, but he kept on kicking for a while. And I think he's suspected of killing a couple wives. But, yeah, still give me Jerry Lee Lewis over anything that came 1964 or after.
It's a very interesting observation. I'm going to have to catch that podcast because I was just saying to Mrs. Julie today, right, that what were John Lennon's last words? Bugger off, that's not a real gun. And that's...
I didn't know that.
There, wow. Up there on the level with they couldn't hit an elephant at this dis.
Wow. <It's>, wow, he deserved it. I mean, for plenty. I mean, I don't feel bad about it. Actually, man, you're familiar with John Hinckley, right?
Junior or senior?
The one who shot Reagan. who just got out and is now a folk singer.
Oh, wow.
Okay, yeah, and he's doing
some old school bluegrass.
I think he has a podcast too, but he has got a Spotify where he's doing folk songs, and he's some MK Ultra mind. They've removed his brain at Quantico or wherever the hell they had him. But Nick, the artist of the he corresponded with John Hinckley, and John Hinckley specifically asked him. John Hinckley he didn't go to prison; he went to a mental hospital, so he had furloughs. He had weekends with the family. John Hinckley specifically asked Nick to draw him a picture of Jodie Foster naked in a meadow surrounded by John Hinckley's letters to her. And Nick drew it for him, sent it to him. Within a few days, Nick had the Secret Service at his door, and John Hinckley was denied any further furloughs just because of that.
I once typed Tulsi Gabbard in a washing machine into an AI art generator. I'm pretty sure the Fifth Directorate is going to come crashing down on me like a ton of bricks anytime now, but it is what it is. It's just one of those things when you're just a young man on the internet trying to get things done. But we do have a book to discuss. Now, what I found interesting is that, and full disclosure, Jim, before the show, I said the difference between you and me is you're a fuck up from a poor family, whereas I'm a fuck up from a rich family. And fuck up though I may be, I still understand the culture of, high class, middle class white people. They like to be entertained by minstrel shows. And it's not always black people who are in the minstrel shows. I remember... remember when Duck Dynasty were in the news 15 years ago?
And Honey Boo Boo. Commentator. Hmm? Here comes Honey Boo Boo, the obese family from Georgia. Yeah.
Right. There is a commentator. She's a libertarian and Jewish, Ilana Mercer, so take this with a grain of salt. But she used this term to describe Duck Dynasty, which has stuck in my head ever since, redneck minstrel show. And you look at Duck Dynasty, really is. It is these guys, they may be real, they may be false, but they are what nice white people, what middle class, stuff white people like to think about middle America, about rednecks, about hillbillies. Even if we are sympathetic, you like to look down on them a little bit.
Oh, sure. But
you're better than them.
I
got the feeling during this entire book that Vance was putting on this show for me of just how dysfunctional and rednecky and hillbilly-ish his family is. He's putting on this show for his reader, who's an upper or middle class white person, to make him feel better about themselves. Look, you're fucked up. You got problems. But at least you're not like these hillbillies. Mm-hmm. There is because it's coming from a hillbilly and he's portraying them as human, well, it's not cruel, right? It's a minstrel show, but it's not a minstrel show because he's got so much compassion for these people. You know what I'm trying to say here, Jim?
They don't even do scripted TV shows anymore, as far as I can tell, but... I was going to say the real surfeit of these kind of minstrel shows were in the 60s with the Beverly Hillbillies and Green Acres and Petticoat Junction. And this is what they like to call othering. The comedy was like, look at these idiotic bumpkins. Jethro, the hypersexual, and Ellie Mae. I mean, Ellie Mae, oh, good Lord. That girl. Or Wrangler Jane from F Troop. These fecund. And it goes back to Little Abner. Little Abner was just this, you'd talk about a Chad, that was a hillbilly Chad, and Daisy May, these hyper-sexualized but lovable bumpkins. They're not too dangerous, though. And if you look at a lot of old depictions of blacks, it's the same thing. Somebody sent me this 9-CD set of racist cartoons from the 40s, and it's usually just these adorable little black kids going to get cookies. They've got gigantic lips and everything, but going to get cookies from their grandma. Where it turned for whites toward the mid to end of the 60s, these lovable but harmless bumpkins suddenly became the monsters of Deliverance and Easy Rider Whereas the rednecks killed the American dream. They blew away, you know, Dennis, or who got killed? It was Dennis Hopper, I think. Thankfully, he was worse than Peter Fonda. I think they killed the right, the rednecks in the truck killed the right guy in Easy Rider. But that's what I know too. Like rednecks, the malevolent, murderous, rapist redneck became a much more prominent figure in pop culture in the mid to late 60s. That's, and horror movies, you've usually got one-eyed gas station attendant who has children buried in the, you know, beneath the cement in his station. That's been a constant ever since. And that's much more troubling because, or, you know, My Cousin Vinny, even at something like that, where they go down south, immediately they're in prison and, you know, there's a kangaroo court. You just get terrified of it. Or I always bring these up because when you go to see, when you're like 4 or 5 years old and your brother takes you to see a trilogy of gore slasher movies, he used to work at the drive-in down in Clifton Heights, Pennsylvania. One, I remember even the order I saw them in. It was Herschel Gordon Lewis was the director of all three. They were backwards from when they were made, 65, 64, and 63. It was Color Me Blood Red, 2000 Maniacs, and Blood Feast. Intensely, irredeemably gory. But 2000 Maniacs was about this town that had been decimated by Union soldiers 100 years earlier. And they rise from the quicksands 100 years later and divert these Yankees coming down to go to Florida into Pleasant Valley and one by one brutally torture them. And that's, you don't have any malevolent, murderous, rapist black, even though, like, if you check the crime statistics, pretty much all of the inbred rape, I mean, there's tons of incest and inbreeding in black communities too, but you just, it's just not accepted. But yeah, to me, his whole fault was he blamed the personal failings. And personal, like, again, it's much more complicated. There's not one solution to everything. It has, but it only goes so far. If you don't have access to water, pull, you know, or you don't have boots, you're not going to be able to pull yourself up by the bootstraps. Sorry.
Right. I mean, in that aspect, what he describing as hillbilly behaviors, they may look like, oh, these are crazy personal failings to someone who's maybe, you know, let's call it uneducated, but it's someone who has read David Hackett Fisher's Albion's Seed, right, for British folkways in North America. The fourth folkway being discussed is the hillbilly folkway. You understand that this is these people's culture. Mm-hmm. And this is something that the positive aspects of which Vance is proud of. He's proud of the honor culture. He's proud of his great uncle, right? Or his uncle, I forget. Yeah, his great uncle. When he was younger, a boy was saying that how his grandmother, he'd like to eat her panties because, you know, he'd like to fuck her, essentially. So what this guy does, what the great uncle does is goes back home, gets some panties from the wash, gets some of the grandma's panties from the wash, and forces the guy to eat them at gunpoint. That will learn him.
Yeah,
that will learn him. That will learn, and apparently it did learn him. And that's something that J.D. Vance is proud of. But when it comes to aspects of that culture which clash with the modern world, such as, for example, needing to defend your honor as a driver, or wanting to retain your independence in the face of coal companies or the steel companies, the Armco steel company, that which basically transplanted entire towns from Kentucky mm-hmm. into Ohio. And this happens also in Michigan and Indiana and New York and Pennsylvania. Everything adjacent to hillbilly country, everything adjacent to Appalachia, the major companies, the major industrial conglomerates simply pilfered Appalachia for mm-hmm. able-bodied men, for labor, just transplanted them away from their communities. And now we're wondering some years down the line after deindustrialization why these communities are dysfunctional when they were built around these factories, right? Mm-hmm. Vance does not recognize that the culture is a totality, and that some aspects of it are inimical to the modern world as has been constructed, mostly by other people, by other cultures. Fisher will admit that basically the culture of New England Brahmins, the New England Yankees, is dominant in America and has been since at least the end of the Civil War, if not before. And just some of these things, and of course there's other groups which are pushing out the WASPs, which are pushing out the Yankees, have completely pushed them out, and their culture is even less compatible with that of hillbillies. So what's personal about this, and what's major historical trends which no one person has real control over? You know, especially not the son of a coal miner who's the son, you know, the son of an industrial worker who's the son of a coal miner in rural Ohio or Kentucky. What control, what kind measure of control could this person possibly have over such major tectonic changes in government policy and industrial policy?
I think I understand enough about human psychology that people are going to pick whatever political platform most justifies their existence. So if you're born rich, these people are fuck-ups. If you're born poor, they stole the wealth, you know, unfairly. But it's hopelessly complicated. I guess people need easy answers, and that's where I fail to deliver. I don't think there are. I'm only good at figuring out how other people's answers are flawed. I've never once tried to offer an answer. And maybe that's a weakness, or maybe that's just honesty. But yes, I'm sure maybe the dumb ones stayed in the hollers of Kentucky. Maybe the ones who were bright enough to get a scholarship were able to get out. But pulling yourself up by the bootstraps and personal, it only goes so far when there, like I said, there's one gas station in town and no industry, and nobody wants to buy your yams because there are better yams being grown in Tennessee or whatever. These are things that are out of your control. And it's corny, but I think of the Serenity Prayer, which until very recently I thought was from St. Francis, the one who loved the animals. It was actually from the guy who founded Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's like, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. There are some things you just cannot change that are completely out of your control. And to get upset about it or think you can is naive and destructive. So yeah, that's what you can change. Yeah, change it. And it's your fault if you don't. But you have to realize there are some things that are out. There are opportunities that are denied to certain people, especially if you're remote from urban centers. You better have some family wealth, or you're going to be eking out a subsistence existence for the rest of your life.
Well, that's a good way of putting it. I mean, we are right wing, for better or worse. And one thing I've noticed about the right is it's enamored with this myth of personal responsibility. And people in the chat have been saying all night, oh, it's an American thing. No, it's not. In Europe, again, the right-wing people don't like people who complain, people who say, them's the times, that's the economy, or that's the situation. But sometimes, most of the time, I would say, them's the time, that's the economy, that's just the way things are. There's very little you can do to change it. And you have to accept that essentially we are, as individuals, or maybe even as groups, just leaves in the wind. You know? Maybe we are buffeted around by forces we do not see or understand. And our lives, the major events of our lives, we have very little control over them. And we should stop pretending we do. I'm personally sick of pretending I have control over my life.
There's a lot of terror for a lot of people in saying, I don't know. People crave certainty. Right. But I guess you have to make peace with the fact that you're never going to be certain about hardly anything. I'm fairly certain the sun will come up tomorrow, but maybe there'll be a solar flare and everything in the sky. Who knows? But I guess it's a human need to need easy answers, you know, have everything retardedly simplified to the point where you're so simple-minded that, like, you can't figure out anything. And I think that's where most people are these days. And it's hilarious to every, what was it, Norm Macdonald in the special that he did that was released posthumously. He said, you know, when I was coming up, like, everyone only had six opinions, and they were usually about food. Now everyone has an opinion on everything. And so you go online and people are completely uneducated about everything. They know all about the vaccine and it's good or it's bad, everything. As arrogant and self-centered as I am, this is what I was saying to somebody the other day. Like, some of this stuff, I do it for a living. I have no idea what the hell I'm talking about. I can throw rocks and hope they hit the target. That's about it. There's really no shame there's more shame in not admitting you're wrong and saying, I don't know. this is what I suspect a lot of things. That is as about a definitive as I can say. I think this is what's going on, but there could be a piece of the puzzle I'm completely ignorant of. But no, everyone's an expert. It's infuriating. How often do you see someone say, I don't know? Or they have the prepaid cluster beliefs. If you're right wing, you will know what they believe about everything because it's been prefabricated and served to them in a, you know, freeze dried. It's like a TV dinner.
It's like the drugs. It's getting corporatized and centralized. You used to have people with nuanced opinions. You used to have, you know, business Democrats, and you had blue dog Democrats and socialist Republicans or whatever. I don't know. Now everyone's just one of two things, and it's depressing, right? Humility doesn't sell. See, that's the thing I noticed being a, you know, on social media, on Telegram, on Gab. I offer my honest perplexity and uncertainty to people, and I'm less popular than people who are decisively wrong in the right minute. They call it,
but
you know,
confidently, stupidly and confidently wrong. It was what Mencken said. He said that Americans, they don't admire truth tellers. They admire the most extravagant liars. Because, yeah, right. People want easy answers. Someone comes along and says, this is what's going to happen. This is the way it is. It's the way it always be. We're winning. We're going to. People will flock to that again and again and again, and they never learn. But, yeah, I think, you know, it's self-serving for both of us to think that, like, not being unequivocal, like, has harmed us as far as progress. But you see these people come and go, and they're like meteors. They don't last because eventually their predictions, you know, people realize, hey, he's never predicted anything and been right about it, but they need that assurance, yeah.
I don't know. Maybe you're older than me, so your horizon is, you know, a bit longer. But from what I understand is that if you can keep that, they call it copium and hopium, right? Dripping into people's minds on social media and keep the hot takes going, just get everyone's dopamine right up. You can last for a very long time and have your takes be nothing but hot shit. But it is what it is, I guess. We have Norse Nature donating one diamond. No comment from Norse Nature with that diamond. Well, thank you for that, sir. It contributes to our fundraiser. We are grateful for it. Now, for the last part of the show, we have like 10, 13 minutes left, Jim. I want you to compare and contrast Mr. Vance's book to your own Redneck Manifesto. I was originally going to bill this show the Virgin Hillbilly Elegy versus the Chad Redneck Manifesto, but I thought that might have been a little on the nose. So let's do a little shilling. Is it going to be part of the Answer Me anthology?
What about the Answer Me anthology? Should I?
Is the Redneck Manifesto going to be a part of it?
No, Answer Me was a magazine. There were only four issues. This is the anthology. That ended in 1994. The first thing that I released after that was the Redneck Manifesto. It was written in 96, came out in 97. And as a plumber's son, I mean, I was most likely an accident because I was one of four kids, but the nearest sibling was 12 years older than me, and then 13, and then 17 years older than me. So I'm pretty sure I was an accident. But my brother, in 1967, he would have been 19 years old. He tried to go to Temple University, where I wound up going in the 80s for journalism. This Catholic, Irish Catholic boy from the suburbs, brick row homes, suburban Philadelphia, he went into urban Philadelphia in 1967 and saw the riots and the hippies. He thought Vietnam was safer, so he went off to Vietnam. He was too freaked out by that. But I decided to, you know, I decided not to become a plumber. I wanted to be an actor, got accepted, but the parents weren't going to go for it. So I drove a cab and went to journalism school. And you realize after a while that the creative professions aren't necessarily the most creative people. They're the people who have the time to develop a creative career, which most people from the working class don't. So I've always kind of had my feet in two different worlds. And never really fit in and never really needed to fit in either one. But what blew I was, as a boomer in the 70s and 80s, all you had were three TV stations and what was at your local library. So I was convinced that, you know, everything they said, oh, the blacks were kept down and being white was bad and everything else. But It slowly chipped away with experience with blacks and other things. But one of the things that really nailed it home was when I got married for the first time in Vegas by the Reverend Walker Goad. And yeah, entirely disconnected. Like I said, couldn't tell you either grandfather's first name, never met either one of them. And I didn't even know the derivation, the etymology of the word goat, of the name goat. I got married by the Reverend Walker Goad in a trailer park in Las Vegas. And I asked him, I'm like, what's the history of the goats? Who were the first goats in America? He said, it's an English name. And they were indentured servants and convict laborers sent here by England. And at the time, I was immersed into thinking that I was the descendant of slave owners and should feel guilty about it. And I started looking into it, and I ran across Michael Hoffman's They Were White and They Were Slaves, a ton of books, and researched it. And I also noticed that the people in the creative fields, the writing, if writing can be construed as creative, they, at the time, everyone was crying tears over the deforestation of the Amazon due to acid rain, and we were having benefits for it, and you know, the Live Aid for the Ethiopians. But if something bad happened to some poor white trash anywhere in rural America, these people at the magazine thought it was hilarious. So I started investigating, well, why? And why was I duped into thinking that I share some guilt? I should actually be mad about what happened to my ancestors. And my, you know, my dad dropped bombs on Germany. And he had his mind destroyed from it. My brother fought in Vietnam, had his mind destroyed. What were we guilty of? And I'm one of these people. I've learned to tamp it down because you can drive yourself nuts. When I find out I've been lied to, I am furious and I never forgive. I wish more people were like that. I think a lot of people, as long as they're well-fed and have something to watch on TV, they don't really get mad about anything. They get mad about what the libs are doing or what something really, but when it's a fundamental lie, I will
to be mad about.
Too old to
basically, there's a lot of encouragement towards conservative white people in America to be mad about the libs, to be mad about, I don't know, some general threat overseas. But what's actually being done and has been done to you historically, you're not allowed to be mad about that. So they're not. There is no permission to be mad about white identity servants. There's no permission to be mad about demographic replacement, about black crime, about cultural erosion. There is permission to be mad about those libs.
Right. It's a distraction. Does anyone in the chat know, is there any memorial, a statue, a museum anywhere in the United States devoted to indentured servitude? I've never heard of one. You got a million Holocaust museums here, even though it didn't happen here. You know, so others would say it didn't happen anywhere. But that's always like, we don't have memorials to white indentured servitude in Greece or France, so why do we have the Holocaust museums here? Interesting question. What can the only possible answer be? I'm not sure.
It is, and that was your motivation, I guess, for writing the Redneck
Manifesto. Yeah, I've been lied to, and I was furious about it, and decided to just dig deeper. And Hoffman's work is invaluable. And what was fascinating to me is scholars who actually labor scholars, and they can be all across the spectrum. They all agree that 2/3 of the whites who came to the colonies came in some form of bondage. It was not this. They couldn't possibly have been all been entrepreneurs. Another thing you think of, whites always outnumbered blacks in America. How is it possible so 10 whites owned one black slave? That doesn't work. That's never the way it works. It's like the We Was Kangs things. I was talking about this earlier today. You know, we was presidents. Like, we had a country where everybody was the president. It's like, that's not how it works. the slave owners were always a very slim minority of whites.
Right. And a specific minority concentrated in Virginia and the South, which, you've mentioned before the sheer contempt in which the English ruling class has held the English people ever since there has been an English people and an English ruling class. Or you could say that it's because fundamentally, the English ruling class is not English. It's Norman. That's different.
Sure.
They conquered England. They slaughtered the English, the Anglo-Saxon aristocracy, and replaced it. And this is something that which has been commented on by historians and sociologists. There's a joke, right? In Croatia, everyone is a count, right? Because every village, because the reality of navigation along the Dalmatian coast, every village was basically its own county and had its own bishopric. So the elder brother would be the count, the younger brother would be the bishop, or something along those lines. But as a reality, the average European country would have 5 to 10% of this, its population be some form of aristocrat, some form of noble, of greater or lesser nobility. So that's 10%, okay, maybe 5% of the population. That's a significant number of people. And they were, for the most part, of the same ethnic group as the people they were ruling over. So there was a great deal of noblesse oblige. There was a great deal of paternal attachment.
Or consanguinity, is that how you pronounce it?
Consanguinity, exactly. Right. Whereas in the United Kingdom, and more specifically England, right, to a lesser degree, Scotland, first of all, the number of aristocrats after the Norman conquest was significantly lower, right? Because the Normans just replaced these, killed the entire Anglo-Saxon aristocracy and replaced them, and each had much vaster holdings than the bannermen of the Anglo-Saxon kings. That's the first reason. The second, they were not of the same ethnicity. They're close enough, right? They're Normans, so they're basically Vikings transplanted into France, French-speaking Vikings, but distant enough to actually make a difference, to see the English peasantry as the other, and thereby exploit them ruthlessly. This is an attitude which later infected the Scottish aristocracy as well. You can read about it in the Highland clearances and the elimination of croft farming. This is a generational problem in the Anglo-Saxon world of basically the ruling class being unbelievably hostile to the population, something which you do not see in Europe outside of maybe the Ottoman Empire.
It's another great argument against pure capitalism, because it allows things like that to happen without any kind of national identity. Well, the Normans can come and just squash the English peasantry for 1,000 years, and nobody even notices because they look well enough alike. But that's a thing. There is, and I mean, I'm an elitist in a lot. I don't like dumb people, but I think I wrote this in the first Answer Me, in the intro article, that I said I'm a dangerous motherfucker. I'm white trash with brains. That's why I keep talking about straddling two worlds. Is I kind of see it from both perspectives. Maybe that's unique, or maybe I'm just kind of some mutant freak hybrid who is not destined to thrive. I'm not sure, but that's something that doesn't. It's all become cultural, and people have forgotten economics. I think the fact that we're in the worst economic state we've been in my lifetime, I think that's the reason, because people want the culture war and to look away from economics, because it's too depressing. You're going to blind yourself if you stare right into it. It's that bad.
Indeed. And so we have slowly come to the end of our 2 hours together, and we have a last minute donation from Pterodactyl B-Cat over on DLive for 2 ice creams. And Pterodactyl B-Cat further says that this Christmas he's going to buy himself the gift of a subscription to the Countercurrents paywall. And that's very generous of yourself to yourself, Pterodactyl B-Cat. There's a lot of perks to being behind the Countercurrents paywall. You can read all of the paywalled articles immediately. You can, which includes all of the replays of the writer's block, which are paywalled. Otherwise, you're going to have to wait for 30 days to listen back to the replays and read the articles. There are some other perks which shall become apparent as you move.
Yeah, once forward. You're behind the wall. Oh, you have no idea the perks behind the wall.
It's basically, let you have a gander at my own very personal stash of hot takes and black pills.
Yeah, there you go.
It cost the last guy $200 to find out, but, hope springs eternal. Let me just refresh the entropy page, and, no new donations. So I guess, Jim, have you got any concluding words for tonight?
I'm going to be corny here. I know Thanksgiving isn't a global phenomenon, but it is, it served me to sometimes just get a piece of paper, put a line down the middle, everything I'm griping and moaning about, put on the right, everything that's bad in my life. But sometimes it's helpful to take inventory on the left side of that. Think about the things that you actually are happy about. That's about as corny as you're ever going to hear me get.
Well, I think that you singing "I've Always Been Crazy" was cornier, but it is my favorite occurrence on that on the distant right ever. That song has been stuck in my head for a year now, I guess. So.
I've Always Been Crazy, that one.
But it's kept me from going insane. Right. It's one of those things, I guess. Well, I guess this has been the Writer's Block, people. I'm your friend and host, Nicholas R. Gilvey, and our guest for tonight was Jim Goad. We were discussing J.D. Vance's, well, now he's a senator, so Senator J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy. We took a very critical eye to that book. I recommend that you read it. It's interesting. It's basically a hillbilly minstrel show if you're into that thing. And I want to thank everyone who tuned in to listen to us live. I want to thank everyone listening to the replay. We do this for you. We edify you so you may become a better white nationalist, more effective activist for our cause. I want to thank everyone who chatted, who commented in the DLive and Odyssey chats. You would not believe how much what you write, your discussions drive the discussion on the show, how much I rely on you. Well, I guess you can believe it. I guess there is a way of gauging that. I also want to thank everyone who donated across all platforms. Your donations are what makes this project possible, what makes the broader Countercurrents organization possible. You have my eternal and unending gratitude. And finally, I want to thank our courageous and indomitable moderators, Gadius Maximus, Bartleby, and Reed Johnson, for keeping the chat safe, keeping all of the links available to our esteemed audience so that everyone can read everything at their leisure once the show is done, obviously. And with that, folks, I want to wish you bye-bye, people.
Sayonara. Take care.